talked about your many gay friends. Would you and Michelle be comfortable attending their commitment ceremony?
We would. You know, I'll be honest with you that these days, I can't go anywhere. Long time since I went to a good party.
And he said, why do you have to keep saying boyfriend? He said, why do you have to rub it in our faces like that? Okay, we get it. We get that you're homosexual. And I said, I say it the same way that you've said girlfriend 5 times over the course of this conversation.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Brazil's president laments lawmakers' homophobic hypocrisy, Obama opens up on LGBT issues, and getting fully engulfed by humorist David Sedaris. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Pam Marshall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 20th, 2008. The president of Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, strongly defended the idea of civil unions for same-gender couples during a television interview this week. He also criticized politicians who oppose rights for lesbi-gay people but still seek their votes and take their taxes. We must stop this hypocrisy, he said, because we know they exist. There are men living with men, women living with women, and many times they live extraordinarily well. Lula became the first national leader earlier this year to launch a conference to specifically focus on lesbi-gay civil rights. Consensual adult homosexual acts have long been legal in Brazil, but homophobia and gay bashing remain significant problems in the country of 184 million people. Brazil's constitution defines marriage as between a man and a woman, and a civil unions bill granting same-gender couples many of the rights of married heterosexuals has been stalled in Brazil's Congress for more than 10 years. But battles for equality have been successful in a few Brazilian states. Rio Grande do Sul established same-gender civil unions in 2004. Rio de Janeiro grants equal benefits to the same-gender partners of state employees. And a Sao Paulo state court allowed a gay couple to adopt a 5-year-old girl in late 2006. A series of court rulings in the predominantly Roman Catholic country have also given gay and lesbian couples some rights in areas such as immigration, welfare, pensions, and inheritance.
The Paris AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP, protested Roman Catholic Pope Benedict XVI prior to a mass he conducted during his visit to the city last week. Benedict regularly denounces same-gender couples, and the church has consistently opposed the use of condoms to prevent HIV/AIDS. The protesters erected a large banner which read, "The condom is life," and laid a large black and pink carpet down the stairs of the venue to, as they said in a statement, denounce the obscenity of the red carpet deployed in Paris by President Nicolas Sarkozy for Benedict XVI and his reactionary theses. Opposing condom use, they charged, amounts to facilitation of evil. There were reports that LGBT and AIDS advocacy groups were under extensive surveillance prior to the Pope's visit.
At least 5% of gay men in Beijing are HIV positive, and too many gay men are having unsafe sex, according to a statement issued earlier this month by the Beijing Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Deputy Director He Zhang told reporters that local gay men use condoms less than 50% of the time when they have sex. Meanwhile, he said, infection rates have dropped from needle sharing, blood products, and mother-to-child transmission. The number of HIV cases in China has always been unclear, but it's believed to be at least 650,000, according to the Ministry of Health and international health organizations.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, announced last month that the annual number of HIV infections in the country is 40% higher than previously thought. The agency confirmed during a conference call with reporters last week that the highest rates of new infection are among Black, gay, and bisexual men, especially those under 29 years old. Of the more than 56,000 Americans diagnosed with HIV in 2006, 72% were gay and bisexual men. Of those men, 46% were white, 35% were Black, and 19% were Hispanic. The new figures also show a much higher HIV rate among women of color than for white women. Kevin Fenton, director of the HIV/AIDS division at the CDC, called the new data about Black gay men alarming and said that 80% of them never come in contact with CDC-approved HIV prevention programs. But only 2 of 18 CDC programs specifically target Black gay and bisexual men. Activists have consistently criticized the CDC for long ignoring the group most affected by HIV. Cornelius Baker, National Policy Advisor for the National Black Gay Men's Advocacy Coalition, said in a statement that, despite continuously accumulating data, there has been little commitment from policymakers and elected officials at the federal, state, or local level. The silence still equals death.
An Australian government report this week announced an almost 50% increase in the number of HIV/AIDS cases in that country over the past 8 years. It says the surge is in large part due to Australian gay men bringing the virus home with them after vacationing in Asian countries with high HIV infection rates, such as Thailand, Papua New Guinea, and Fiji. The report by the National Center in HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research was also critical of the federal government, noting that Australia was once among the world's leaders in HIV/AIDS education, but the cutbacks in funding have crippled prevention efforts.
A report in the UK, National Guidelines for HIV Testing 2008, is recommending that sexually active gay men be tested for HIV at least once every 12 months. Recent figures show that more than 30% of gay or bisexual men living with HIV there don't know they are infected. The National AIDS Trust, the UK's leading independent HIV/AIDS advocacy group, endorsed the new guidelines. It reported earlier this year that symptoms of early-stage HIV infection are routinely misdiagnosed by doctors. It also found that 30 to 50% of new HIV infections are thought to be passed on by people in the early stage of infection, so the need to catch new cases early in order to prevent the spread of HIV is a top priority. The new testing guidelines were published by the British HIV Association, British Infection Society, and the British Association of Sexual Health and HIV.
In other news, John Burnside, longtime partner of the late LGBT rights pioneer Harry Hay and an activist in his own right, died on September 14th at his home in San Francisco. He was 91. Hay died in 2002 at the age of 90. Longtime friend Joey Kane told the Los Angeles Times that Burnside was in declining health and had recently been diagnosed with spongioblastoma brain cancer. In his early career, Burnside's interest in optical engineering led him to invent the kaleidoscope, a variation on the kaleidoscope that transforms what the viewer sees into a colorful design without the use of colored glass chips. His California Kaleidoscopes became a successful design and manufacturing company in Los Angeles. He later created the Symmetricon, a large kaleidoscopic device that projects patterns, which was used in several Hollywood films. But it is for his relationship with Harry Hay that LGBT people will best remember Burnside. Hay led a handful of men who formed the Mattachine Society, a pioneering gay rights organization in Los Angeles in the 1950s. Burnside met Hay in 1963, and after what was called a whirlwind romance, they moved in together and remained a couple for 39 years.
Hay and Burnside were a highly visible activist couple in Los Angeles throughout the 1960s. They founded the Southern California Council on Religion and the Homophile in 1965, and a year later took part in one of the country's first gay rights demonstrations, a 15-car motorcade through downtown Los Angeles to protest the ban on gay men serving in the military. But they were also active in the anti-war movement. In 1979, frustrated by what they saw as the queer rights movement's drift toward mainstream assimilation, the couple helped organize the first spiritual gathering of radical fairies at an ashram near Tucson, Arizona. Since that first event, which drew about 200 men, the fairy movement has held dozens of gatherings around the world. "The people who have come to the gatherings came looking to find themselves," Burnside once said, "but they found each other too." The couple relocated to San Francisco after Hay's health declined. A group of radical fairies, dubbed the Circle of Loving Companions, cared for the two men during their final years. Mark Thompson, a well-known lesbi-gay historian and longtime friend of Burnside's, told The Times that Hay and Burnside were totally committed to peace and justice issues on a wide spectrum of social concerns, including Native American rights, women's and labor issues, fair employment and housing, They were just good social activists. Plans for a memorial service in San Francisco for John Burnside are pending.
And finally, U.S. televangelist Pat Robertson and other holier-than-thou homophobes often warn that God uses bad weather to punish those who accept gays and lesbians. So he'll have a hard time explaining why one of the few businesses left standing in the wake of Hurricane Ike, which devastated Galveston, Texas last week, was Robert's Lafitte, a gay bar. It's become a major gathering spot now in the city of 60,000. Some 20,000 people are thought to still be on the island, and emergency workers are on the scene. Food and water remain scarce, and residents have been told that it could be months before full power is restored and the city is up and running again. People have been dropping off food and other necessities at the bar for anyone who needs them. Brian DeLeon, a grateful self-identified heterosexual, told the Reuters news service that he'd never thought of entering the bar before, but that, "These are the people who take you up out of the water and make life livable. Once I get back to work, I'm coming back here." The bar's owner, known locally as Big Mouth Robert, told Reuters that the building was flooded with about 3 feet of brackish water, but after mopping up, the bar reopened the next day. They're even offering a drag show, and in an apparent salute to the woman who was also notoriously battered by another Ike, her husband at the time, a Tina Turner sing-along. Big Mouth Robert summed it up nicely. "We're survivors," he said.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 20th, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Pam Marshall.
You'll hear things a best-selling author will never know about himself later in the program. The venerable LGBT weekly Philadelphia Gay News tried for some time to arrange interviews with the two major candidates for U.S. president, Republican Senator John McCain and Democratic Senator Barack Obama. According to publisher Mark Segal, it became clear that McCain would not participate, and the decision was made to go forward with an Obama exclusive. Segal questioned the senator about how an Obama administration would approach several LGBT issues and about his historic campaign.
"You're the most LGBT-friendly candidate running for president in history. Are you concerned that John McCain and the Republicans might use this as a divisive issue as they did in 2004?
No. I mean, I think they can try, but I don't think it'll work for a couple of reasons. Number one, yeah, I think that the American people's attitudes with respect to LGBT issues are continuing to evolve, but I think that they are, you know, people are becoming more and more aware of the need to treat all people equally, regardless of sexual orientation. There's some people who disagree with that, but frankly, those folks probably, you know, many of them, probably had already made up their minds about this election earlier.
You've talked about your many gay friends. Would you and Michelle be comfortable attending their commitment ceremony?
We would. I'll be honest with you that these days I can't go anywhere.
Well, you can take your Secret Service guards with you.
Sometimes since I went to a good party.
The current President Bush has used signing orders to change military rules and regulations. If White House counsel advised you that you could end Don't Ask, Don't Tell by attaching a signing order to a military appropriations bill, would you?
I would not do it that way. And the reason is because I want to make sure that when we reverse Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we have built the... It's gone through a process, and we've built a consensus, or at least a clarity about what my expectations are, so that it works. I mean, my first obligation as a president is to make sure that I keep the American people safe and that our military is functioning effectively. And although I have consistently said I would repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I believe that the way to do it is to make sure that we are working through processes, getting the Joint Chiefs of Staff clear in terms of what our priorities are going to be, and that's how we were able to integrate the armed services, to get women more actively involved in the armed services. At some point, you've got to make a decision that that's the right thing to do, but you always want to make sure that you're doing it in a way that maintains our core mission in our military.
Many lawyers contend that the Defense of Marriage Act passed by Congress is unconstitutional. It takes away over 1,100 rights, including IRS joint filings. If a suit is filed in federal court, would you expect or up to your attorney general to join in that suit with an amicus brief questioning its legality?
You know, I would want to review carefully any lawsuit that was filed. You know, this is prior to my carryover from being a constitutional lawyer. But here's what I can tell you. My principle is don't ask, DOMA, I think, was an unnecessary encroachment by the federal government in an area traditionally reserved for the state. I think that it was primarily sent as a message to score political points instead of work through these difficult issues. I recognize why it was done, and I'm sympathetic to the political pressures involved. But I think that we need to bring it to a close. And my preference would be to work through a legislative solution. But if the court, I would also point out that if it's going before this court, I'm not sure what chances would have to be overturned. So I think we're going to have to take a different approach. But I'm absolutely committed to the concept that it's unnecessary.
In last year's History Project, Elaine Noble, who was one of the first elected officials in the country, referring to her discussions with Harvey Milk, said, "I think we both knew that one of us was going to die." Milk, of course, was killed. As the first African-American president, have you and Michelle discussed this?
You know, we don't spend time worrying about security issues. We have Secret Service protection, which is the best in the world, and obviously we take precautions and listen to them. But what I spend the day thinking about is how do I get my message out that we need to change this country to make it more just and more fair, to make sure the economy is growing on behalf of middle class Americans, make sure kids can go to college, that we're bringing this war in Iraq to an end. That's what I spent my time thinking about.
Okay. In the wake of the torture murder of Matthew Shepard, Senator McCain voted against adding sexual orientation to the definition of hate crimes and says he'll vote against it again. Isn't this inconsistent for a man who knows torture?
Well, you'll have to ask Senator McCain that. Here's what I can say is that, there's no doubt that hate crimes based on sexual orientation are all too prevalent. It is something that we have to hit back hard against, and identifying these vicious crimes for what they are, hate crimes, is something that I believe in and will continue to believe in when I'm president.
President Reagan, President Bush, and President Clinton, when meeting world leaders, have raised human rights questions. Amnesty International has documented countries that imprison, torture, and kill gay men, some of which are very close U.S. allies. Would you be willing to raise that question when meeting with those leaders?
I think that the treatment of gays and lesbians, transgender persons, is a part of the broader human rights discussion. And, I think it is not acceptable that we would in any way carve out exceptions for our broader human rights advocacy to exclude violations of human rights based on sexual orientation. I think that has to be part and parcel of any conversation that we have about human rights.
That was an exclusive Philadelphia Gay News interview by publisher Mark Segal with Democratic U.S. presidential candidate Barack Obama.
And I'm Maria.
And together we're Zrazy.
And we're crazy about This Way Out,
the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
April in Paris. Chestnuts in blossom.
The latest book by public radio humorist David Sedaris is called When You're Fully Engulfed in Flames, a title he discovered in a Tokyo hotel's English language safety guide. It was burning brightly at the top of the bestseller list during his tour of Australia when he encountered This Way Out correspondent John Frame in Brisbane.
You're here to talk about your latest book, When You Are Engulfed in Flames. Now, I've had a listen to the audiobook over the last couple of days, and it's a really diverse book. It's a good exercise, isn't it?
I like books on tape, but not my own. Like, I've never listened to my own, but other people's I do. And I like the way that when you listen to a book, I like the way that it befalls you. Because when I listen to a book, I think of that book. Like, for instance, I just finished listening to some Jonathan Franzen essays, right? He wrote a book called How to Be Alone. And when I think about that book, I think of the countryside in Normandy, because that's where I walked to the countryside listening to that book. So I associate it with a bucolic landscape. Or other books I associate with ironing or hotel rooms in the United States. But when you read a book, it's rare to associate a book with a place. You don't like to think, oh, I remember I was lying on that couch when I read that book. But when you're out in the world, like books on tape allow you to be out in the world and be in the book at the same time. I like that.
When you first listened to your own voice in a national public radio broadcast, I believe, you were lying in bed with your head under a pillow. Have you gotten more used to your own voice these days?
No, I accidentally listened to part of a radio broadcast a couple of years ago. And that was it. Cannot. If I get call my house and I get my voice on the answering machine, I'm depressed for weeks. Can't do it. But I write for a magazine called The New Yorker, and you can get The New Yorker, you can get an Audible version. And so it's these people, and they're not actors necessarily, but they read every word of the magazine. So whenever I have a story in there, somebody will read it. And I actually enjoy listening to those versions because it's not the way I would read a story. You know, I would read that particular story, or I was reading something the other night. I was listening to something the other night, and it was about a babysitter that we had growing up, and the voice that this person gave the babysitter was like not the voice at all that I gave her, that I remember her having. But that didn't bother me. I was able to hear the story and hear faults in the story and hear good things about the story by hearing it out loud. But if I tried to listen to my recording of it, then I wouldn't have been able to get past my voice.
But for us, we get to hear what you actually sound like. When you can write that you do Billie Holiday impersonations, but we can hear that you really do a very good version, don't you?
You know, I don't think it's that good. I used to think it was good, and then I heard it. And then I thought, oh, no, this is like... You know, there's a way you sound in your head, and there's a way you really sound, and I mistook the two.
Now, Australia would have no trouble after watching the 7:30 report on Australia's national broadcast of the ABC the other night. No trouble knowing that you are, in fact, a homosexual. And do you find that it's surprising as you travel around the world that people will point to your sexuality as a prime subject?
You know, I don't really feel like they do, but it was interesting. I just finished a long book tour, and golly, I lost track of all the radio interviews I did and, you know, and TV a couple of times. And I never felt like anyone made it, that it was a big deal. Like somebody, but then I was in Canada, and I was interviewed by this fellow for a newspaper in Canada. And he said, why do you have to keep saying boyfriend? He said, why do you have to rub it in our faces like that? Okay, we get it. We get that you're homosexual, okay? And I said, well, I say it the same way that you've said girlfriend 5 times over the course of this conversation. Like, or that I say it the same way that someone might say my husband or my wife. Like, I'm not expecting it to be any big deal. You know, it's just a person that features in a lot of my stories and that features prominently in my life. And so I say boyfriend. I didn't think anything of it. And I never read anything about myself. Like, I never read any reviews. I don't read interviews ever. But there was something about this guy, and I liked him, you know, but I was curious too. And what his writing was like. And I was at the airport the next day, and I thought, well, his article came out. I'm just gonna see. And he described me as slight and effeminate. an effeminate, you know, like if you're gay, like when you hear effeminate, and there are people that conjures a mental picture, and there are people that I can think of that would, but I thought, really, am I? But then I thought, well, maybe he was just like such a he-man, and like he had such a problem with like the word boyfriend, that maybe that's where that came from. But really, that was the only time that I ever felt any weirdness or any hostility or anything about that. It's striking to me, right? Because I'm 51. So at the time that I grew up, and especially growing up in North Carolina, if you had the word boyfriend in a book and you were a man, then your book would be in the homosexual section. Well, there wouldn't even be a homosexual, so your book wouldn't even be in the library. It would vanish from the library. It would not be in the bookstore. I don't know how people would. And a little later on, then it would have been in the gay section of the bookstore. You know, that doesn't mean you talked about sex or anything. You used the word penis or anything, but you had the word boyfriend. So you would be in the homosexual section. And it's pretty remarkable to me, just over the course of my lifetime, how that has changed, right? And now you can just be at the bookstore at large. You know, you can just be in the nonfiction section or in the fiction section or in the humor section. And so it's interesting sometimes to go into a bookstore and see where the book is. You know, because there are still people who will say, oh, well, that's in the gay section because you're gay. And so it's like, well, do you have a black section, you know, like where everybody who's black is? Or do you have like a women with curly hair section? But to me, just in the 50 years since I've been alive, like, who could have imagined those changes? You know, who could have imagined? I mean, I certainly could not have. It seems huge to me.
John Frame will pick up with David Sedaris where they left off, talking about his brand of subtle activism.
But I thought to, like, screech at people, I didn't think that was going to get me anywhere. But if you could just sort of write stories about your boyfriend when he was pertinent to the story, or write about being gay when it was pertinent to the story, that seemed better, because then you would have people say, well, there's that guy on the radio and I like him and he's a homosexual, so I don't see what all the big deal is about.
More with the author of When You're Fully Engulfed in Flames next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Chris Wilson, Pam Marshall, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and John Frame contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help support our work. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive our weekly email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening on WSUI Iowa City, Iowa, KZSC Santa Cruz, California, 2NUR Newcastle, New South Wales, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.